And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, your host for the hour, and today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2019. The show airs live. It streams live at KUCI.org, and following the show, it will be podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. So if you want to hear it again or you want to send your friends to the show, send them there. And subscribing to Writers on Writing on iTunes is great because it helps the show show up for others who are new, who are looking for it. Today, my guest is Sean Levy, his author of the narrative nonfiction book, The Castle on Sunset, Life, Death, Love, Art, and Scandal at Hollywood's Chateau Marmont. Welcome, Sean.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you. Before we went on the air, I told you that I finished the book last week and I loved it. And I just want to hear how it came about.
Well, I had been gathering string for about 20 years for a book about the Sunset Strip, which I think is a really, it's one of the most famous roads in the world. And it's a place that the world has often looked to for ideas about fashion, music, cinema, of course, and lifestyle, sex, and how we comport with one another. And I've never been able to quite nail that. And I was having a conversation with an editor about that idea, and he said, "What about Chateau Marmont?" And the book just blossomed in my head immediately, sort of like one of those origami flowers that grow in a bowl of water, and it just opens up. I didn't know all the details, I didn't know all the stories, all the characters, but I knew what the shape of the book would be, and I knew how the Sunset Strip would fit into it.
So that's interesting. So you said you were gathering string for quite a long time, and so I imagine you were working on other projects in the meantime.
Right.
Talk about the gathering string. What does that consist of for you?
You know, there's a couple of things. Sometimes I know in advance that I'm interested in a subject, and I'm actively looking. If I'm in Southern California, for instance, I'll go to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science Library, spend a day digging out archives, taking notes, making photocopies, and I'll put them in a folder and maybe never touch them. Other times I stumble across stuff and, you know, it's like finding the thread on a sweater, and really I am trying to unweave the sweater, unknit the sweater. So there are really two ways. Sometimes I'm out looking for the stuff. Perhaps I find things I didn't know existed or wasn't looking for but are useful. And sometimes I just stumble across a story that I didn't know, and I think, what is this? And I start scratching at that. I wrote a whole book about a guy simply because the first time I saw him, I was fascinated. A Latin play of the 50s named Porfirio Rubirosa. And I thought his name sounded like a jazz riff. And when I read about him, I was like, oh my God, this guy's a book.
Interesting. Yeah, so much that you write about is about the chateau, about Sunset Strip, about LA during the time that the chateau was coming to be is so interesting. One of the things that I really liked was how you talk about, how discretion is and was important to the chateau, to its success. And I went there for the first time in March, and we couldn't find the entrance. And it was before I read your book, and I think I saw it in the display case, a pre-pub copy or something, up in the lobby, but we could not find the entrance. And I thought, this is so interesting. I mean, this is part of what it's all about. We finally found a stairway that led up to the lobby, and I thought, okay, is this on purpose? Of course, reading your book, it was on purpose.
Yeah, it was built not as a hotel, but as an apartment building. And, a hotel usually has a grand entry where you're met by, parking valets or bellboys and, paparazzi laying in wait. But an apartment building, you just kind of pull into your garage and your parking space, and you get in your elevator and you go up to your unit. And because it's a hotel and because it caters to show people, discretion is very important. You know, you're not going to last in the hotel business if you're giving away secrets, whether your clients are famous folk or not. But here's a place that has, you know, folks staying who are avoiding the press. And it was literally built for privacy. So it was a happy coincidence that show people found it and turned it into the place it is.
So when it became a hotel, was there talk, was there any thought to creating an entrance that was easily findable, or you know, was the whole idea to keep it as it was, that it's a hotel now, but discretion is still a major aspect to this place?
Well, when they built it, there was nothing else there. It wasn't so hard to find because the Sunset Strip was an unpaved road, and, you know, there were very few buildings, you know, hiding it. Today, you know, as you're going east on Sunset Boulevard, you hit the Sunset Strip, which is a series of curves, and Chateau Marmont disappears from your sight almost as soon as you take it in.
Yeah.
And if you're coming from the west, you don't see it until you're almost past it. So, you know, today it's a trick, but in 1929, when the doors were opened, you saw it from miles away. It was like Mount Shasta. Mm-hmm. And then when you got there, it was pretty obvious how to get in. Today, not so much. And the renovations over the past 25 years have made it even harder. You used to be able to park on Sunset or on Marmont Lane, and there was a set of stairs that brought you up into what is now the restaurant area, which was sort of like the front lawn. And you entered the lobby through the door that now separates the restaurant from the maitre d' stand. So they, over the years, in order to expand the facilities of the hotel, they've kind of trimmed down on the entrance. But, you know, it's only got 63 rooms, and the restaurant is small, and the bar has, like, five stools. So it's not like they're looking for a bunch of people to come.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI-FM in Irvine. I'm with Sean Levy. His book that we are talking about is The Castle on Sunset. So Gathering String, I'm having some trouble with my headphones here, so I hope you out there can still hear what's going on. Gathering String took so long. How about the writing of the book?
The writing of the book was pretty straightforward. I work on a contract. I generally allow about 12 to 18 months from the time the contract starts to the time I deliver a manuscript. And this one, it was hard to figure out the structure of this book because it's a biography of an inanimate object. It's the history of a building. And I'd never written anything quite like that before. I've written biographies, and I've written about moments in time that had clear beginnings, middles, and ends, like London in the swinging 60s. This, it took me a little while to crack the structure, but while I was pondering that, I kept writing the stories. You know, it's like, the book is like a hotel in that people come and go. So Jean Harlow is in it prominently, but only for about six pages, just as Jean Harlow was in the hotel prominently for only about 6 months back in the 1930s. Ditto James Dean or John Belushi or Lindsay Lohan. As you move through their stories, you know, you have beginning, middle, and end again and again and again. So I was able to compile those while I, just sort of like a deeper part of my brain, figured out how to put it all together. And that was the tricky part. The strategy I finally hit on was to build the book into chapters that represent the owners of the hotel, the five important owners, and the one period of sort of helter-skelter ownership. And that gave me a broad beginning, middle, and end story. It doesn't resemble a biography. because the hotel is thriving 90th year. God bless anyone who can say the same for themselves or their loved ones. But it does have sort of the structure of a single story.
Yeah, I quite like the structure, actually. It seemed to flow from, I don't know, there was just such a nice chronological, path that we followed, we the readers follow. And I don't know, I loved it.
I loved what you did.
Speaking of Helter Skelter, you, in an interview I read with you, I think it was with Los Angeles Magazine, you talked about one of the most surprising things you came across in your research, and that was regarding Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate.
Right. They moved to Los Angeles before they were married. They met in London in 1966 or 67, and they moved to Los Angeles so that he could work on Rosemary's Baby and she could work on Valley of the Dolls. And she had previously had leased places or owned places, but she was very fond of Chateau Marmont. So they took a suite in the hotel. And they were staying there when they were married. They were married in London. They flew to London. They flew people with them. And then they came back, and she told him that she was pregnant and that she didn't think it was appropriate to bring a newborn baby back to a hotel. So they went looking for a house to rent, and they wound up renting the house in which she was murdered. It's just a real tragedy, but it is connected to the hotel in that, you know, our understandings of hotels are we expect them to be very responsive to our needs and, you know, kind of creature comforts and pampering us. At the same time, we think of them as slightly déclassé and naughty. And because of that latter quality, Sharon Tate didn't want to bring a newborn baby.
Yeah. That's so sad, and especially because, I don't know about especially, but the murders were not intended for them, right? It was somebody else that had lived in the house.
Tenant.
Yeah. So, gosh, there's so much to talk about with this book, and I want to get to the research again and how you were able to access the research and talk to living souls about the hotel. Would you talk a little about that, how you went about researching?
Sure. It's a 90-year-old hotel, and it was built by someone born in the 19th century. So there was quite a lot of archival work. You use libraries. I mentioned the Motion Picture Academy Library on La Cienega, which has deep files about people connected to the film business. There's a similar library in New York City connected to Lincoln Center, which, even though this hotel is in Los Angeles, had material that the LA Library did not. One of my favorite tools is to use old newspapers, which, God bless, you can do from your home now. Search PDF versions of the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, for mentions of the hotel, for people who you knew were staying there from roughly the time of their tenancy. So, treating it like Abraham Lincoln or Napoleon, you know, looking for documents, looking for, contemporary accounts. That's part of the work. And then part of it is talking to people, as you say, which is tricky. Everyone who works at the hotel and has worked there since the 1990s has signed a non-disclosure agreement with the current ownership. And those folks are really protective of the hotel's reputation as a discreet location. So their employees don't talk, and they have sued employees who have spoken to the media. But there are people who worked there before them, and of course there are guests. So if I was talking to someone in showbiz, I would say, I'm writing a book on Chateau Marmont. You must have a story.
Mm.
And of course they did. And it's one of those things where, like, okay, you didn't get this from me, but I saw so-and-so doing such-and-such.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you can't use it. It's defamatory, it's unreliable, but sometimes you can triangulate, you know, with, say, another source and say, goodness, you know, that person was staying at the hotel at around that time, and that story is not defamatory, it's amusing, and you can go ahead and publish it.
Hmm. Did you leave anything out that, in retrospect, you wish you had kept? And if so, well, actually, besides that, how did you decide what not to include in all that research?
You know, there are things that are defamatory, that satisfy the requirements of libel, and you know, Doubleday is not about to publish them just because I think it's a good yarn.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in my career, I learned what those laws are very early. My first book was about Jerry Lewis, and he was antagonistic toward the project, and it was filled with revelations about his life. So I learned from a libel lawyer in advance of publication how to protect myself, how to make sure that, you know, I'm not subject to litigation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole swath of material that couldn't go into this book simply because certain movie stars' attorneys would be on the phone. I almost said names. Certain movie stars' attorneys would be on the phone with Doubleday, and it could get ugly. And then there are stories that you can't prove, you know, urban myths or stories that, you know, are quote unquote too good to be true. And if I can't, if I only have one source and the source isn't necessarily reliable on other material, then I won't use the story. And then thirdly, there are things that are just extraneous. There's just no way to wedge them in, not even with a footnote. And perhaps they're trivial, but they charm me, or I think they would charm readers, and yet I can't find a way to get them in other than just sort of like a shopping list of here's 20 stories, which I don't think is very satisfying to read or to write.
Hmm. Are there favorite stories that you came across that you did include in the book? I mean, is there a favorite resident or story that came out of somebody you talked to? Or,
you know, there are people both in, you know, among the residents and among the employees who I grew fond of as I learned and wrote about them. Helmut Newton, the photographer, the bad boy fashion photographer whose images were filled with kind of S&M and nudity. And he was a charming guy who would sweep through the lobby and pick up stray people who didn't seem to know anybody and take them off for fabulous meals. And he and his wife stayed at the hotel every winter for something like 15 years. I was charmed by him. I was charmed by the owner, Raymond Sparlot, who owned the hotel from about 1975 to 1990. And he was this gruff construction worker. He had once been a butcher. He became a contractor and developer of tract housing in the San Gabriel Valley. And I think he bought the hotel as a teardown, and then his marriage was ending, and like so many Hollywood folks, he moved into Chateau Marmont while he was getting divorced. And he fell in love with the place, and he sort of rescued and restored a lot of what had decayed under previous owners. And, you know, he was just this big, gruff guy who always had, like, a soup stain on his tie, and yet he rescued this cultural landmark that you know, the whole world is grateful he saved. So there are stories like that. You know, there's a story about, I'm always amused by it. They used to have a service where they sent, if you went out on the town, took your car and got overserved, they would send a parking valet and in a car with a second valet, and the second valet would drive your car back to the hotel. And there were a couple of screenwriters who were having a toot one night and realized they were too drunk to drive. and they call the hotel for the car service, only to realize after a minute or two that they were drinking in their hotel room.
That's great. I love that story too. I think that's great. You had a story about Dominic Dunn too. So I guess he had videos or something.
Yeah. Dominic Dunn stayed at the hotel throughout the 90s and early aughts when he was covering the celebrated Hollywood trials of the Menendez brothers and O.J. Simpson and Phil Spector and Robert Blake. And he stayed at the hotel for months at a time. And he was, after one of the trials, he was flying back to New York. He'd packed up his suite and was moving back east. And he realized in flight that he had left a VHS porn tape in his VCR. And he called the hotel as soon as he landed, and he said, you must get that out of there before the maid discovers it. She thinks so highly of me. And the assistant manager went to the room, found the tape, and then called him back and said, would you like me to send it to you? And he's like, no, destroy it.
That's great. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Sean Levy. His book is The Castle on Sunset, Life, Death, Love, Art, and Scandal at Hollywood's Chateau Marmont. I think everybody, everybody who watched Saturday Night Live and is familiar with the fact that John Belushi died in the Chateau. And I don't know if, for me, I wonder if that's when Chateau Marmont came on my radar screen. I'm sure it did for others. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, as I said, geographically, the hotel is kind of hidden, even though it's on one of the busiest streets you can name. And it's not prominently identified with signage, and it was always a discreet place that, you know, those who knew, and those who didn't know didn't need to know. So that was, you know, on one hand, that brought you certain clients. On the other hand, it suppressed business. And when John Belushi died in 1982, the hotel became famous overnight. Of course, there was the crush of, you know, paparazzi and looky-loos in the days immediately following his death. But then there was, you know, a kind of Hollywood tourism trade where they go around and look at, you know, where people who died young lived, or, you know, they might stop by the scene of Benny Siegel's murder or where River Phoenix died. And Belushi's death hotel was part of the tour always. And also there were people who wanted to touch that place because of the infamy associated with it. So in the months and years after Belushi's death, there were actually people who requested his bungalow. They wanted to stay in his room, including Jean-Michel Basquiat and Rick James. So, you know, the hotel went from being this hidden secret to this open secret to this famous thing, kind of, you know, tragically. And ironically, but it really did put it on the map. And it's sort of like if the hotel was a person and its obituary were published, the death of John Belushi would be in the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. People, you know, flocking to places where there's been tragedies. It reminds me of Graham Parsons. I think there's a motel in Desert Hot Springs or somewhere out in the desert where he died, and it's people want to stay in that room. I find so interesting.
And it's as if there's a plane crash. We're like, oh, I almost took that flight three years ago. You know, there's I think an association that we make with A, celebrity, and B, you know, a close call with death that somehow, you know, gives us a sense of being alive or being, you know, notable. It is a curious thing. And this hotel has had a couple of, you know, sort of sensational incidents. I mentioned Helmut Newton. He had a fatal heart attack while he was driving out of the garage. And there was a little while when there was sort of a floral tribute to Helmut Newton on the side of the road there. that had a similar effect. People came and photographed it from fashion magazines all over the world.
And Lucy and Desi, Lucy and Ricky.
Yeah. Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball had a very tumultuous marriage, regardless of what they showed us on their sitcom, I Love Lucy. And Desi was a world-class womanizer, and he was constantly getting thrown out of the house. And like many men over the decades in Hollywood, when his marriage was ending, he took a suite at Chateau Marmont. In his case, he was in and out of the place so much that the parking attendants and bellboys sort of thought of him as a permanent resident. And he entertained young ladies in his rooms without using the shades for privacy. And the hotel employees figured out certain vantage points where they could see what was going on inside.
Oh, I swear. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about you and your writing background.
Sure.
Because I didn't realize that you have an MFA from UC Irvine, where we are broadcasting, and it's in poetry.
That's right, yeah. I got an MFA in poetry in 1985. It was a two-year program, and you know, it was very tiny at the time. The campus was small. There was one little shopping center across the way with Albertsons and Bob's Big Boy and dry cleaner and a not great Mexican restaurant. And, you know, it was almost like a rural campus. I lived in grad student housing in Verano Place. And, you know, you'd hear coyotes in the hills. The Irvine Ranch was still sort of a working cattle ranch. And it would, you know, and this is not very long ago. And soon after I got the degree, I became a dad and I was kind of stupid enough to look in the want ads every day in the Los Angeles Times for writer and editor. And I found a job at a movie magazine in Hollywood, Box Office Magazine, which is a trade magazine for theater owners, and parlayed that into a better job. And in 1992, moved to Oregon, where I became the film critic of the newspaper here, and I started writing books. So, really, there is for my mind, there's a direct line from UCI to the career I have. The fellow who hired me at Box Office Magazine was married to a grad student from UC Riverside, and when he mentioned to her that he had a candidate for this really lowly job who was an MFA student from UC Irvine, she says, "Oh, hire that guy. that guy will be good." Huh. And on her blind faith, here I am.
So what was the carryover for you from poetry? And are you still, I mean, do you read it still? Do you ever write it?
I have never stopped reading poetry. The biggest section of my library, you know, in terms of number of titles, is probably poetry books. They're slender. so they fill a bookcase, but there's many more of them than film books in the same size bookcase. I started writing poetry again about 4 years ago and have a book of poems coming out next year, 2020.
Oh, excellent.
Based sort of on the kind of work I do, but different, obviously, if they're poems. And for me, the carryover is language and love of language, using unusual words or familiar words in sentences that make you read them twice and put a smile on your face when you see where you've been led by simple language. You know, writing in a newspaper, I think poetry was a good discipline to have learned because it's so much about concision and, you know, 140 syllables in a sonnet, no more, no less. And in newspapers, they tell you, yeah, this story needs to be about 8 inches long. You know, that idea that you're measuring your work by with a ruler, I think goes along with sort of formal poetry. It's my partner calls it my crossword puzzle brain. But, you know, there's something similar in composing sentences and seeing sort of structural dimensions to a piece of writing that, you know, is similar whether you're working on a 10-line poem or a 100,000-word book.
Hmm. Are there poets that you love or have followed over the years?
Oh, yeah, of course. My favorite book of 2019 is by a poet named Ross Gay, G-A-Y, and it's called The Book of Delights. And it's a small volume, and he set out for a year to record something every day that delighted him and meditate on what aspect of this was delightful or what the delight felt like as opposed to other types of delight. And the book doesn't have 365 of them. It has about 100 of them, probably the best ones. And it's delightful. I mean, it just makes you look at your shoelaces or, you know, a broken basketball rim with a different set of eyes. And so much of the best art is sort of grueling and takes us to, you know, confront dark places. I really treasure the writers who are able to bring rigor and beauty to happy places. I know from writing movie reviews, thousands and thousands over the years, it's much easier to write a pan than it is to explain to people why something is great. It's easy to poke holes in something than explain why it moves you. And this book concentrates on, you know, the greatness and what moves you, and it's really delightful.
Mm. So when you were in poetry workshops, would they be more critical, or would the structure be more like, you know, talking about perhaps what the writer had in mind or what themes came through?
We had pretty strict guidelines to procedure in the workshops. You would submit your work to your peers. Back in the day, you would literally make Xeroxes and slip them into their mailboxes in the grad student area of the English department. And on the day of the workshop, they would have your poem, and you would read it aloud, and then you would sit there, and they would talk about it. And then at a certain point, the instructor would turn to you and say, okay, what do you have to say? And one of the things I learned there, which was really useful, given the very public sort of writing I've done since, newspapers especially, is that it doesn't matter what you thought you were doing. What matters is what people take from it, because you can't follow everyone around and say, oh, and when you read that, bear in mind that I was thinking of this and this and this, or, you know, that phrase is an allusion to such and such. If it's not on the page, the reader's not going to pick it up, and it's not going to be conveyed. So that was a huge lesson for a young writer. Mm-hmm. And it was frustrating. You're sitting there in the room and they're not seeing what you intended, and you just want to, you know, scream and yell, but you don't.
Right.
It was a good discipline. And then the focus on just, you know, getting, you know, people would question your commas and, you know, your word choice and the sound of three or four words banging against each other. Mm-hmm. And that sort of focus on tiny, tiny, tiny elements of craft has really stuck with me.
Hmm. So I don't know if it's if there's another carryover into excuse me, how you revise, but could you talk a little bit about revision and in particular to the Castle on Sunset? You know, you have your draft, or did you, are you a writer that needs to perfect a paragraph before you go on, or do you get barrel through the draft? You have the draft and now let's see what we have.
Yeah, more the latter. As I mentioned, you know, I composed sort of in chock-a-block fashion, since I didn't really know the structure. You know, I've written biographies, say, of Paul Newman, and, you know, it's easy. He was born, he lived, he died. You just follow the sort of chronology. And this hotel has a chronology, but it didn't have a through line the way a biography does, at least not the one that I could see at first. So I started writing bits. You know, I mapped out sort of roughly the decades, and I said, okay, well, in the 50s, I'm going to include this story, this story, this story. And I would write them as I felt ready to write them. So perhaps I was ready to write about Anthony Perkins or the making of Rebel Without a Cause early on in my process, even though they come halfway through the book. Or I didn't want to write about Lindsay Lohan until the last minute. And even though she comes about 80% of the way through the book, she was perhaps the last thing I wrote. And I would save each of these pieces, you know, in individual files on a hard drive and print them up and occasionally work on them, you know, groom them and, you know, smooth them and enhance them and make them clearer, you know, the sort of things you do on a second read through. And then I had to save some time to put it all together because I wasn't sure where in sequence certain things would go. You know, there, when you're writing a multi-threaded history, you're often dealing with simultaneous events. And you can't do that on a page. You need to put them in certain order. You need to put in the flags and say, actually, this is 3 years before the previous bit, but you know, it will catch up. Or you know, you use little guideposts like that. And so there's a portion of the composition period that's dedicated to assembly, almost like if you're making a gingerbread house and bake all the different panels, and then you have to assemble them. So the baking process, things can go in any order, but then when you assemble them, you really have to have a plan. And the plan came to me late in this case, and I was able to find, you know, you put the pieces together, you sand down the places where they meet, and you hope it reads through. And I've done it enough times. I've written several of these multi-thread narratives and sort of learned how it works, and it gets easier each time. Not perfect, and I always need an editor and a second or third set of eyes, but I have learned how to do it.
So as you were working on this book, did an idea for the next project come, or do you have to be completely through with a project?
No. I'm looking for ideas when I walk down the street. Uh-huh. I have files that, you know, I think of as prospective ideas. You know, I don't investigate them. I might, you know, if there's a day when I just don't feel like I can write pages usefully, you know, my biorhythms are off or whatever it is, I might spend a day sort of noodling around on a different idea, thinking, is this worth pursuing? You know, in some cases, while working on a book, I come across, say, resources, reference materials, or a character, a person, or a subject that I think, oh, there's a whole book connected to this. Years ago, working on Jerry Lewis, I found an archive of papers from the film producer Hal Wallace. He made Casablanca. Mm-hmm. He signed Martin and Lewis. He signed Charlton Heston and Shirley MacLaine and Elvis Presley. He was a major film producer, and he kept everything. And all of his papers, legal papers, transcriptions of phone calls, memos, are sitting in an archive in Los Angeles. And I've always thought, you know, I may not be the guy, but somebody, there's a whole book on this guy, Hal Wallace, ready, waiting for someone who just sits in that room for a couple of months and goes through that material to find what they need. So you do find things along the way, and you know, you're hoping one of them is the one that you can convince a publisher to go ahead with next.
How do you know when you've found that one? Is it an idea that you obsess over, that you keep coming back to, or you've just found so much material that, and nobody's done anything with it, that you have to, or What is that thing?
There, that latter point is really important. In my view, I need to find a hole on the bookshelf. Either there's nothing on the subject, or the only books on the subject are very old, or they're inadequate, you know, poorly researched, poorly written, poorly conceived, whatever that may be. That's important. I also, you know, this is my livelihood, and I have an agent, and I have an editor. In nonfiction, all the contracts I've ever signed give the publisher the right of first refusal on your next project. Mm-hmm. So I can simply say, you know, what do you think of Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks or Sean Penn as a subject for a biography? Or, you know, what do you think of, in this case, it was the Sunset Strip.
Mm-hmm.
And in conversation, sometimes my agent will say, somebody just signed a deal to work on a Sean Penn book, so mm-hmm. there's no hole on the bookshelf anymore. Or, you know, he'll say, you know what, there were two books on similar subjects that didn't do well. Nobody's going to publish that. And then sometimes they kick back and give you a different lens that lets you see the book you eventually wind up writing. So it's at least in the coming up with the ideas, it's in my head, but in bringing them to the world, it's collaborative.
Mm-hmm. Will you write shorter pieces as perhaps palate cleansers?
I do, but not necessarily. Well, they're often related to the material at hand. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in Chateau Marmont, I would occasionally, to get started at my desk, if I was beginning a new episode, a new chapter of the book, a new longer storyline, I might write a page or two about, say, hotels qua hotels. Like, what is our sort of ontological state of mind when we go to a hotel? I would write perhaps about James Dean. He appears in the book, and he never stayed at the hotel, but Rebel Without a Cause was created at the hotel. And I did write a paragraph or two about, you know, sort of the myth of James Dean and the image of James Dean in popular culture that's not in the book. And in retrospect, that's what I was doing, sort of clearing my throat and getting ready to work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're a little bit late. I'm with Sean Levy. His book is The Castle on Sunset, Life, Death, Love, Art, and Scandal at Hollywood's Chateau Marmont. And this show will be podcast following, but in the next few days, let's say, on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also visit my website, penonfire.com, and there will be a link there to the interview. So I hope you can hear it from the start if you haven't. So I follow you on Instagram and perhaps on Facebook, I'm not sure, but can you talk a little bit about the role of social media in, you know, in releasing a new book, and if you feel that it has an effect on getting readers or getting people to come out to your events or whatever?
Boy, that's an interesting thing because it changes with every book.
Mm-hmm.
This book was published in May of 2019. My previous book about Rome in the 50s, fashion, cinema, and the birth of the paparazzi, came out in October of 2016. And even in that brief 2.5 years, things changed quite a bit. Social media and, you know, sort of digital media has almost entirely replaced newspapers as a conduit for book talk, book reviews, book chatter. If you get 10 print reviews of a book now, you're, you know, sort of a superstar. And it used to be, you know, back in the 90s or even the aughts, you'd get 20 or 30 routinely. So that has migrated to digital media. And then this idea of a conversation of teases. Instagram is a funny one because it's mainly visual. And I hit on an idea of just posting iconic images of famous folks who stayed at Chateau Marmont and are in the book. And I did it every day for, it's gone on for about 2 months now. And I, you know, for me, that was fun. Photo research is part of my job. And I got to find images of people either at the chateau or at chateau-looking places at roughly the point in their lives when they were residents of the hotel. I don't know if that sells books or keeps the conversation going. I know that certain images sort of spread more virally than others, and when they do, you wind up with more followers. But I don't know how that translates into, you know, a career. I know it's one of the few metrics that, other than actual book sales, you can follow. But my agent, who's very savvy about these things, says, you know, just remember that the one number that really matters is, you know, how close you come to earning back your advance so that these people think that they should be in business with you again.
Right, right. It's interesting. What about a site like Goodreads? Do you find that useful? And do you read your reviews?
I think it's useful because it spreads word of the book among an audience of people who self-identify as book lovers and book readers and book buyers. I tend not to read reviews, partly because I wrote reviews professionally for almost 30 years, and my standards for what makes a review worth reading are higher than you get on sites like Goodreads or Yelp or Amazon. I expect them to be arguments, not just gut reactions. So, you know, it's like if you're a violinist, you're not going to go to see too many Suzuki Session 1 showcases of six-year-old kids playing their instrument and thinking, this is wonderful, this is great music. Also, you know, I think like many authors, the good reviews, I think, you don't know what you're talking about, and the bad reviews stick with me like tattoos. So I'm better off not. I get a sense, oh, it's like 4.1 or 3.8 or, you know, the stars average. But I any time I've ever gone digging through them, I've regretted it. It's you know, cost me hours of therapy.
Yes, I hear you. And speaking to your point about posting photos on Instagram, I do love seeing those. And I also love the ones you included in the book. I think especially the one of Nicholas Ray's bungalow of the cast and crew reading through Rebel Without a Cause. I love that photograph. I love Natalie Wood's feet. There's just something about how into reading this script she is, and everybody really. But how did you choose what photos to go into the book?
Yeah, that's something that isn't widely known about nonfiction. It's in my contract that I will provide the photos. If I'm going to do 8 pages or 16 pages, that's a conversation with the editors. I always want to find photos that either I haven't seen very often or specifically illustrate someone or something that's so prominent in the text, you need to have it in there. But a funny thing has happened. Not really a funny thing. Over the decades that I've been writing books, the photo archives that used to exist in New York, Los Angeles, and other cities, often the morgues of newspapers, which are filled with physical photos, have all disappeared. They've been gobbled up by corporations like Getty, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, and Corbis, which is owned by Bill Gates. So it's Microsoft and News Corp. And they have physically taken these photos and moved them to archival spaces. I've heard about, you know, disused missile silos in the Midwest. And it used to be that I could go to New York or L.A. and go to a photo agency and sit down and say, bring me what you've got on Sammy Davis Jr. or Britney Spears. And they would bring a trolley filled with boxes with physical photos or slides, and you could choose these things. And now you go to a website and you type in the name of the person and you see what has been scanned, but not everything that they have. And this is bad in a number of ways. It reduces the universe of available images, because if I want them to go find unseen stuff, I have to pay them a research fee. Secondly, the scan of the photo is not all the information that's in the photo. If you see a photo that originally ran in the newspaper, frequently on the back, there's a piece of paper taped or glued to it that says this was taken on July 16th at LA International Airport when so-and-so arrived from the Philippines. And suddenly you have a date and a time and a place, and you know something about the subject that you didn't know before you saw the photo. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, as in all things, once they consolidate, they jack up the price. Mm. So I used to pay $25 and $30 and $50 for a photo, and now those same photos cost like $350 and more. And
that, of course, comes out of your advance.
That comes out of my fee. So, yeah. The book that I did previous to this, Dolce Vita Confidential, about Rome in the 50s, included shots taken by paparazzi in Rome of movie stars trying to beat them up for taking their pictures because they were running around with people to whom they weren't married. And, I had to deal with the estates of these paparazzi, and they're not going to cut me a deal. This is their, is their bread and butter. This is what their dad created that the family has been living on. So I spent nearly $10,000 on images for that book. This book, I was fortunate because in my gathering string years on Sunset Strip, I had come across material that I put aside and said, I can use this. And, some things you can get rights to simply by owning the photo, say publicity shots. In the case of the Rebel Without a Cause photo, nobody claims ownership of it. It's appeared in two or three books over the years, and I contacted those authors, and I contacted the rights holders whom they identified, and I contacted photo agencies. Nobody owns the rights. So my 8x10 copy that I bought at a memorabilia show in the 1990s serves as ownership. Mm. It's often a legal question, and it's really often a financial question.
Yeah. Well, I wish we had more time. We are at the end of our time, and I have so enjoyed this hour with you, Sean. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much. It's a treat to talk to something connected to UCI.
Oh, great. Thank you. That was Sean Levy. His book is The Castle on Sunset. If you just tuned in, you can go to iTunes in the next few days or sign up, subscribe to iTunes, to Writers on Writing through iTunes or Stitcher. And when we podcast, you will receive it in your podcast file. That's all for now. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. And thank you for being with us.